Hi, this is Ben Durbin. You may know me from the oft-celebrated Life Zero podcast. This is episode 9 of that podcast, and we're going to talk about some things. The things we're going to talk about include pet peeves, the wine list of Perea, and aren't we all just paramecium?
This podcast is proudly sponsored by a local San Francisco restaurant, Perea. Perea is a wine bar and cafe where you can experience a different type of scene. Families and friends getting together, having Mediterranean home-cooked plates paired up with amazing wine. They're located at 795 Valencia, corner 19th and Valencia.
And we have a special guest with us today. Via Skype, we have Charles Rivera. Am I saying that right, Rivera?
Yes, you are. You're saying it perfectly.
Thanks for being with us on the show. Welcome. And just for the listeners' benefit, tell us where you are in the world.
I am in New Jersey, great. Jersey City.
Fantastic. Well, thanks for being with us.
Yeah. And
my pleasure.
Charles, could you tell us a little bit about what it is that you do? You have a podcast of your own, is that right?
Yes, I do. I have an MSB podcast, which is now going into MSB Wiki, and I've done about 330 shows dedicated to my life and surviving multiple sclerosis. And I've had all kinds of interviews and talked to a lot of people around the planet and made a few friends. So it's not great. Having MS is not a great thing, but it's got me my co-host and met lots of interesting people.
Well, why don't we dive in? Let's talk a little bit about pet peeves. Now, I can't imagine that any one of us might have something that they want to start off with. Anybody have any pet peeves? Nothing.
Ben, you're looking right at me.
I'm looking right at you.
Yeah, I know you are. I actually have an interesting point. My two best friends, that the three of us have been very close since high school, they actually, about my freshman year of college, decided that it was time to create the Laura Book of Pet Peeves. And they actually began writing down every time. I was like, man, that's totally a pet peeve of mine. Because they truly did not understand why it was possible or how for somebody to have so many things that annoyed them. And over time, I've gotten much better with certain pet peeves, but there are still a huge number of them that I have.
Do you want to share one of them with us to get us rolling?
One of the big ones is mouth noises, and I think this has been brought up on other things as well. I might have mentioned it before, but like, yeah, what John's doing right now in the microphone. You should talk with your mouth, not make weird noises. I don't know why, but that bothers me.
Do you think this connects to
that's a big one.
You think this connects to the popcorn thing that you have?
It might. It might connect to the popcorn.
I'm seeing a pattern here. Mouth noises, popcorn.
I hate popcorn. It's evil and horrible, and it's an awful, awful thing. Should be banned.
Well, I just don't like it because it usually tastes like nothing.
Exactly. See, it tastes like nothing, and people make weird noises, and they behave oddly and not culturally normal when it comes to eating popcorn.
It's usually done in a theater.
Exactly, and I'm trying to watch a movie, and they're shoving, like, two handfuls of food in their mouth while chewing. It's just not right.
I wonder if it has, does it have anything to do with, what about crinkling bags or candy wrappers or things like that?
Oh, that drives me insane.
Yeah, I'm wondering if it's sort of like a certain type of sound, whether it be coming from someone's mouth or for just sort of crinkly type stuff. In general, might have something to do with it.
I don't know.
Crunchy popcorn and a crinkling potato chip bag strike me as being somewhat similar.
I find it ironic that you don't like it when someone makes squirrel noises with their mouth, but you like squirrels.
Oh, they're so cute. Yeah, I love squirrels.
But they make that noise that
they're
evil-eyeing me for.
That's what they do. That's how they communicate. We don't communicate like that.
Some people do.
I do meow at my cats, though, so I guess I am being a little hypocritical. I do meow at them.
Oh, wow. Speaking of pet peeves.
I have a large cat, and it tends to chirp, not meow.
Oh, that's cute.
Is that a ploy that on the cat's behalf? Because if I were a cat, that's exactly what I would start doing is chirping so the birds would come near me.
No, actually, it's a Maine Coon cat, so it's just it fundamentally it doesn't meow, it chirps.
Charles, I got a cat for my third birthday, and her name was Blackie. She was solid black, and we got two of them, one for my sister as well. His name was Purrs, because he purred all the time, and they were two Maine Coon cats. And I had Blackie from 3 years old until my sophomore year of college. I had to put her to sleep. Maine Coons are some wonderful, wonderful cats. They're just so loving and friendly.
Yeah, and 21 pounds of fun.
Oh, they are. They're huge. They're they're the largest breed of cat.
Yeah.
You know, it's ironic. One of my pet peeves is when people treat animals like little persons.
And I totally do.
And Laura Lee totally does that.
What bugs you about that?
I don't know. They're not little people. I have a feeling that, you know, there's a Far Side where they show someone speaking to an animal and all the animal hears is like, blah, 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 fluffy, blah, 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 fluffy, blah, 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 fluffy.
Right.
I just then have that sort of sense.
The dog's name was Ginger.
You remember the exact panel,
yeah.
Charles?
Uh-huh.
Your memory is completely off the charts, Charles. No wonder you have a Wikipedia thing going on over there. Like, you are Wikipedia.
No.
So while we're ending up with the pet peeves, Charles, do you have one to add to the table?
My pet peeve. Well, usually it's the way people behave in the subway, and you know, they sit right down and they look at me as I'm standing there with my cane, and they just look at me. They don't offer me the seat. They just look at me. It's a pet peeve. It's written on the side of the seats. You know, won't you give the seat to the handicapped or elderly? The problem is that I'm dealing with logicians. I'm handicapped and elderly, therefore I don't qualify.
They cancel each other out somehow in these people's minds.
Yeah. You're like a double negative walking around. That's yep. Interesting. You know what's funny is here in San Francisco, we see this a lot where someone will, you know, sit down. So usually it's someone in their – I found this really ironic. It's someone in their 20s and 30s most of the time. It's usually not a kid. And, they'll sit in the seats that are reserved for elderly and handicapped. But the other thing that people do here, because I have a feeling we're going to talk about a lot of pet peeves, but another pet peeve of mine related to the subway and related to what you're talking about is people who sit on the outside of a seat and leave the inside seat vacant in public transportation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so they're sort of it's like they're intentionally saying, I want both seats and I'm going to make it inconvenient for you if you would like to occupy one of these seats. And furthermore, I've noticed too, the other pattern is if you stand there and you say, do you mind if I sit down? They just lean back and fold their arms and force you to step over them.
I found we could probably do a whole show just on transportation, public transportation related pet peeves, but mine is sort of the... is related to yours in that when I am sitting on the inside and I'm making those sort of rustling gestures that we all make when it's our stop and we're ready to get off and the person who's sitting on the outside seat is not ready to get off, that they won't just – it's not too much to ask, I don't think, especially on a not crowded train, to just get up a little bit because there's not a lot of room in these seats. But the idea that they just sort of – same thing. Instead of actually maybe they'll turn their legs a little bit but not actually just – get up and allow the person off. It doesn't seem like it's a
too big gesture. They instantly become the immovable object.
That's right.
One of my big public transportation pet peeves, and this also has to do with the walking part of transportation, is, you know, I walk to the BART, which is like our subway here in San Francisco, and I get on, and then I ride it to work, and then I get off, and I don't even have to walk a block. It's literally right by my work, which is fortunate. But I do have to go there every day, and there, without fail, there is someone on the way to the BART and in the station that, like, walks in such a way that they're swinging their arms and, like, kind of weaving, you know, like, unconsciously so that I can't walk around them. I understand that you're having a great day and a good morning and you're enjoying a little stroll, but there might be somebody who's on their way to work and actually has to be somewhere at a certain time, somewhere within, say, the vicinity of you. And I just, it drives me insane when people take up the whole sidewalk or the whole pathway to move to get in another door in the train. It just, I don't understand why people are so unsocially aware.
And you're not talking about someone who's heavy. You're talking about somebody who's like a thin or sort of normal-sized person who's just swinging their arms. And
I'm talking about a person that takes up more space than they take up as a form. Like, you know, swinging their arms or, you know, like a group of three friends that are walking next to each other down the sidewalk so that you actually have to turn your body to get past them. It's...
How about Holdy McShopping shopping bag with the six shopping bags that take up about three times the width of their normal stature.
Exactly.
Normal space.
Yeah, we were noticing that people with dogs, bikes, and shopping bags here in the city are the people who they literally take the full measure of the sidewalk on their own. My grandmother, when I was younger, my grandmother was, you know, quite old. She was in her, I think early 70s, but she was still kind of driving. And we would drive, and there would be – we were in this small town when I visited her, and other people would drive too. And she would always look at the other old blue-haired ladies driving. And, you know, in her old sort of grandmotherly voice, she would just be like, I don't understand what it is with old women who take their half of the road out of the middle. I always thought that was really funny. Grandma had a lot of I don't know if I've mentioned her that much on the show, but I have a lot of, like, my grandmotherisms.
Mm-hmm.
She was kind of a foul-mouthed sort of woman who was very headstrong and always in trouble. She was my favorite relative.
Sounds like someone you want on your team as opposed to on the other team.
Yeah. She bought me both my first skateboard and my first computer when I was a kid. So the computer got me into trouble and then later sort of helped me make a career out of something. And then the skateboard... got me into trouble, and actually, I think I told you before, I've broken both my legs and ribs and arms and all kinds of things. So, yeah, both things had a happy ending, but, you know, both things were like, oh, yeah, he wants a skateboard? Let him break his neck on the half pipe. It'll be fun.
It seems like a lot of pet peeves, and we'll definitely get into more of each of the ones that we have, but I wonder if a lot of... the genesis of these pet peeves, they seem to relate to a sort of assumption of some shared cultural value that when the person doesn't do what you expect, and it's usually that they don't do what you expect, right? I'm talking about the person who I would expect someone to get up in that situation on the train, or Charles, you were talking about someone that is looking right at you. It's obvious that they're in a seat that has been reserved for you, and yet they don't do what you would expect, right? They don't get up and make that seat available. So I'm wondering, is it just that there are so many different sort of mini cultural divides, even within a single society, like in America, for example, that there's an expectation that just isn't warranted about a shared sort of set of values?
I think it's just a question of some people never look outside their own eyes. Their sensibilities stops at their own skin, and whatever else exists outside... doesn't exist. It's just they don't see anything. It's a question of being blind to the obvious. It's like I'm on the subway or when I'm driving, I see this all the time, is that people in New Jersey are driving like maniacs because they don't care. They don't see the problem. And then that's when they get into accidents.
Yeah, you should go to Los Angeles sometime and see the way people drive. It's fascinating to me because in LA, it's not that people are bad drivers, because the traffic goes so slow, it's almost impossible to be a bad driver. You know, you're better off getting out of your car and walking. You could literally walk faster on the 405 than you could drive it most of the times. But I've noticed that people there drive very aggressively. And I don't know if it's them being unaware of people around them, or if it's a sense of entitlement that they have where, you know, they are important, they need to be somewhere, you're in their way, they're just going to, you know, merge in front of you. I don't know.
Yeah.
I've always wondered about that. The
problems is that there are various levels. In some cases, they're just unaware. In other cases, like the LA traffic, is that after a while, you get into a situation that causes road rage. And most people are borderline road rage. Same thing with when I was in San Francisco. This was a long time ago, back in the 90s, and there was an awful lot of people who were just very, very pushy. And I can see being pushy, but not to that extreme. And it's just depends on the mass of people.
Do you mean pushy as in they were pushing around on a crowded sidewalk, or pushy in just sort of the way they were dealing with each other verbally, or?
Usually both at the same time.
One tends to follow the other.
Yep. Yeah, I think it's interesting. New York kind of gets that rap a little bit, the rap of people being aggressive or pushy. Mm-hmm. Most of the people I've met in New York are not like
deserved.
That. It's the what? I'm sorry?
It's deserved.
The bad reputation for that behavior is deserved.
It's better than it used to be, but then again, I don't know what happened in the 90s, but at some point, everybody started getting kinder and gentler, and mostly they got the heck out of town, and we lost an awful lot of the awful population, and now the people left tend to be a little nicer. But I wouldn't want to be in the suburbs.
Ben, to your question, I don't know if I think sometimes it has to do with, you know, what we expect from society. But sometimes I think it's just little personal things. Like for me, I have a pet peeve of the way towels are folded. Mm. And it started when I was a little girl. We were expected to do chores. And my dad showed us the way that he folded the towels to put them in the closet. And that's the way you always have folded towels. And when the towels are folded differently, I have to refold them. Or like if the tag from something, like your sheets or your towel, you know, something like that is sticking out, it needs to be redone.
Speaking of towels being folded the proper way, I wonder how much of this behavior is behavior that we have as a result of growing up at a certain time and in a certain place. Because I've been thinking about one of my pet peeves, or I should actually say my pet peeve, or the one pet peeve. Because if I were to take all of the things that irritate me and put them, you know, in a pile.
This is the meta peeve?
It's this one pet peeve, that's right. This one pet peeve would outweigh, you know, all of them by some measure that is greater than infinity. And that one pet peeve is customer service. Mm-hmm. I believe customer service is not just bad, but it's unconscionably bad. And I have had the worst experiences in my life trying to resolve some issue with something I bought or something that was actually due to me because I paid for it over the last 10 years. And it just gets progressively worse.
I mean, the experience of customer service then is bad.
Absolutely. Yeah. If you would like to be offended and just completely out of your mind at the same time, go to the FedEx right off of 2nd or New Montgomery and Market.
Yes, New Montgomery.
So it's north of Market off of New Montgomery. Go in there, and I can't remember her name, but you will recognize her by the, you know, 3-inch painted fingernails and the cell phone attached to her ear and the holding up of the 3-inch fingernail while she's on the phone with her friend talking about how, you know, her friend's sleeping around and all these other things and asking you to wait when you're the only customer in line. That, I maybe it was the way I was raised, which is sort of my point, right? Maybe it's just I have this expectation. Mm-hmm. But to me, you know, the customer is always right in a lot of ways. To me, the customer, you know, without the customer, there would be no FedEx, right? We're the ones that pay for the building she's in. You know, we're the ones that pay her salary, these things. And it's just, it's unbelievable to me how bad a lot of customer service has gotten. You know, I'm shocked.
That's when they stopped paying decent wages and started paying minimum wage. And you get what you pay for. I mean, if I want good service, I go to some store where they have decently paid staff. If I just want to be treated badly and abused, I deal with Verizon.
I think you're right, Charles. I think to a certain degree,
That's a really good point, Charles.
That everybody harkens back to a time, even within a short amount of time, like a decade or something, you can sort of see this decline, and it happens. Our expectations of customer service are what they are. Were based on that previous level of experience, and at the same time, companies are doing their damnedest to make sure that they're spending as little on labor as they can, right, for these functions. So you end up interfacing with folks who don't really have an incentive because it's not a one-to-one thing for them. It's not you at the counter there are the means of them getting a paycheck. FedEx is going to pay that woman, you know, unless she does something really egregious, is going to pay that woman indefinitely.
Right? Clearly, even if she behaves in a way that's really egregious, she's going to continue to work there and get paid.
Right. So it's tough because I think of dealing with airport folks, you know, the folks who are – it's a mind-numbingly awful job, in my opinion, to have to sit there and just check everyone's IDs, right, as they're going through the line there. And that's probably not a very high-paying job. And yet, if you have a brusque sort of encounter with these people, the assumption is still, well, I'm the customer in this situation. Why shouldn't I be getting a good service experience? But if you think about it in terms of, like Charles is saying, what they're getting paid to do that job that you might not want yourself, it sort of puts it in a different perspective.
And if you're talking about airport and airport security and airport greeters, these are people who have something you want. They hold the keys to the airplane. They literally, and that's the only power that they have, is they can make your life miserable while you try and get on the plane. And they will do that because in the exercise of their power, what limited power they have, they will obstruct. If that's all they can do, they will obstruct.
I have somehow, I agree, I think customer service is absolutely horrible and it's gotten worse over time. I have somehow managed to figure out how to change my personality based on like the first 30 seconds of interaction with somebody to get them to be like totally cool and understand. Like I find some way to relate to them
I work more patient. With that.
It might be, but with most things, I'm not very patient at all. So it'd be surprising if that's the case. But I think part of it is that, I'm a little younger, so maybe I haven't had the experience of really good customer service, and so I don't know. I mean, you never know. But
I don't know. I wonder if I think you have. I think you've had really good customer service.
Have you ever been out to a restaurant and had a really good experience where everything just went well? The waiter was there
absolutely.
When you needed them, and they were
absolutely.
Yeah, so there's a good example. They still exist, but you're right. There's a lot of those sort of. I'm at the counter of some large institution type things. Those seems to be the things that people fixate on is those horrible experiences or a call center or something like that.
Well, and I'm all for fixating on great experiences. I mean, I have every single time I go into the Apple store or I book an appointment with the Genius Bar or something like that, I have a great experience. Even if my problem isn't resolved, the person is still really helpful. I mean, that's one of the reasons I'm loyal is because of the customer service experience, which I can actually, call in direct conflict or direct opposition of the customer experiences I've had with, say, IBM or Dell. They've just been awful. And, the other experience, you're talking about a restaurant. I mean, our sponsor this week, a restaurant called Perea, is great food. I mean, really surprisingly great food and great customer service and a really intimate environment. And
wine selection.
Yeah, and they really try. I'm not trying to pimp them, but what I'm saying is they really try to make sure that you have an environment that is comfortable, And they'd rather have you be comfortable than have it be, have it be full or packed all the time. They really want to give you a place where you can hang out. And there are other restaurants like that. Coco 500 is another one here in the city that's really good. But you don't have that experience as often. I wonder how much of that is related to. In the last decade, people haven't really gone through an economic recession in the way that, say, I have or the generation before me had. If you think about it, we had some financial problems, but you look at spending. Spending has not functionally changed regardless of the level of the economy over the last decade. People are still spending like crazy. They're still making a lot of, ridiculous amounts of money and things like that. They haven't had to do what I had to do, which is like roof houses for $4.50 an hour for a summer just to make rent. I think that changes your attitude. You're happy to be at FedEx making, you know, $12 an hour, or $10 an hour, whatever people make there.
I doubt it's that much at all.
You think it's minimum wage?
Minimum wage is like $9.30 or something. I would in San Francisco, I would venture to say that's absolutely what they're making. Because honestly, I mean, they could hire much better for that. And I think they would.
I think, John, I think part of what you might be talking about sounds like that there's a certain humility or understanding that comes from a shared experience related to, in this case, related to what it takes to make ends meet job-wise. And I wonder if it's just, if you haven't had some of those shared experiences, that it might be just hard to relate to. Like if you haven't, it seems like hardship is very relative, right? If the worst thing you've ever experienced is you broke one of those 3-inch nails, then you have a certain worldview, right? But if you served in combat, or you've had a close family member die, or you're dealing with an illness, these sorts of things are kind of relative, and it seems like there'd be an understanding that would come from those experiences that would inform how you treat others and related to these pet peeves anyway.
Yeah. Well, and the media is not helping, right? We're growing up watching, you know, we have a generation of people growing up watching, you know, Paris Hilton in a reality TV show. I mean, if that's not an oxymoron, I've never heard one.
Yep.
Paris Hilton and reality in the same sense is just sad to me to even connect.
Actually, I have a thing about Paris Hilton. She is a distraction. There is no other reason for the existence on the media of Paris Hilton. She's just there to distract. It's just eye candy and making you miss the important things that are actually going on. I mean, Paris Hilton and that's, people of that ilk are just there to waste your time.
Yeah, there's the argument, right, that a lot of that type of media, all of the sort of celebrity worship stuff, is just a distraction for folks to keep them from focusing on how crappy their lives might be, right? If we can play fantasy land and focus on that as something to aspire to while not having to sort of take a look at how we're living day to day or the hardships that we're suffering through.
Yeah, soap operas in the 80s were really big, and then it became Oprah and things like that, and now it's, you know, the two Corys, you know, the Corey Haim, Corey Feldman reunion show, which is in its second season.
Someone said two Corys, and I had no idea. I mean, I know the actors now that you mentioned both their names, but I had no idea they'd bubbled up to the surface again in the media.
Well, sure, you know, you've got Gene Simmons, Family Jewels, and I think it's called Family Jewels. I don't watch any of this, but I'm, you know, I am present and walking around in the city, so I do see a lot of advertisements.
All you really have to do is read the bus advertisements to keep track of what's going on. I remember a space when I wasn't watching any TV, and I would play this little game where I would just randomly throw references into whatever I had seen on the buses as I was, you know, walking around town. I was completely up to speed. I didn't have to know anything about the shows. It's just, hey, have you seen the latest episode of blah, blah, blah? And I was there just through bus advertising.
Nice.
Faking your way to cultural relevance.
I enjoy the reality TV shows in the sense, I don't have cable, so I haven't seen them in a long time, but my sister, who lives in Washington, D.C., has cable, and she's into the reality TV shows for the sole fact that we make drinking games out of them.
easy enough, yeah.
Because, you know,
you're drinking
it's
wine,
so
though.
Easy.
It, you know.
Yeah, we're drinking wine. We are.
If you're taking a shot of whiskey every time they say something
but it's,
stupid, you're drunk.
One of the favorite ones is there was some rapper who was famous for wearing a clock all the time. I have no idea what this
Flavor Flav.
Come on, Flavor Flav.
Flavor Flav, that's it. So it's like Flavor Flav's House of Love, right? And it's basically like The Bachelor, but with him. And so my sister and I were playing a drinking game while watching this on VH1 when they aired like 10 episodes in a row on a lovely Sunday afternoon. And every time he said anything that wasn't actually English, like a word in her dictionary, we would take a drink. And I have to say,
dude, his name is Flava Flav.
I know.
His name isn't even really a set of words.
Yeah. So three episodes in, my sister and I have to go you know, we decide to eat a bagel to, you know, absorb some of the drinking, and then we quit. But
I can't imagine how big the custom dictionary, if Flavor Flav is a Microsoft Word user, I can't imagine how big his custom dictionary must be for all the words huge. That he loves to invent.
It must be huge. But it's, you know, I like watching this kind of stuff because I find it humorous. It's hilarious to me because to think that, you know, that's actually the way somebody behaves is really funny. I don't know. Because honestly, if I were to encounter, it's like these women want to go on dates with this guy. And I'm like, if I were to encounter this guy and he like tried to hit on me or make some comment at me, I would have to laugh in his face. I mean, I would find that hilarious. Like, oh my God, you don't even know how to use English, or, you know, like you're wearing a clock that's two sizes bigger than your head around your neck. You know, I just...
But he knows what time it is.
He knows that's true. If he can read the clock, which I'm not sure about at this point. But I just, I don't know. It's interesting to watch those kind of things because for me, I don't look at them as ignoring my life. I think, wow, I've got it pretty good if this is what other people's lives are actually like.
I think what you were just talking about, I think, is to me a little illustrative of... again, that sort of the idea that a lot of the things that we find maybe a little bit annoying or off-putting, they tend to come from this, people should, your worldview, from your worldview, people should know these things, or they should know how to interact with each other in these, or they should make these sort of, have these, be deferential toward others in these situations. And Charles, if I might ask you, I wonder, have you seen a changing of this over time? Because I wonder if as society gets more complex and the different cultures that sort of, as we influence each other, if there's any hope for any sort of shared idea of those things outside of the context of a family or a fairly small social group.
Well, I'm originally Francophone, and originally my grandfather's a Spanish Civil War draft dodger. Mm-hmm. I was born into a French Francophone family and learned English after. So I've got three types of backgrounds of societies to fit into. Mm-hmm. And I find that the degradation of the social norms tend to have been over the past 30 years. And it's been going downhill. And it's relative, and the speed with which it's been going downhill. I always look back at what we're used to versus what we expect. And what we're used to is always different. It's not better and not worse. I mean, the oldest tirade against the youth of the nation, mm-hmm, was by Cicero, and he was talking about the Romans. So they've always been that way. So I don't expect that I will particularly enjoy what kids are doing these days. And by kids, I mean anyone under 40. So I have no doubt that I'm enjoying you guys. And it's just a question of being with you and enjoying it. That's all there is to it. The things have not really gotten better or worse. It's just they've gotten different. And same thing with my pet peeves. If I'm doing pet peeves professionally, it's one thing. If I'm doing pet peeves from personal life, well, I've got MS and things like that. And it colors your judgment and colors your life. But I'm still changing a third time. This is my third career. Actually, my fourth. I was a musician. I was an English writer, and I got some stuff published. Mm-hmm. I was a musician for a long time. Then I got into computers, and then the last thing I was doing was project management, and now I'm into podcasting. I mean, these things have all changed. They're all stages that I've gone through, and we meet other people who are in other stages. So better, worse, and the thing was that you find that people on your own level, regardless of where they are or what age they are just people on your own level.
You know, it's interesting. So I was in Kansas for a little while, and I noticed that people, when they went out to restaurants in Kansas, this actually relates to what you're talking about, Charles. It may not seem like it, but I noticed that people, when they went out to eat in Kansas, it was a very solitary experience. And what I mean by that is you would have two or three or four people go out to eat, and they would be self-contained. And if somebody at a table next to them tried to communicate with them, they gave you this sort of evil eye and scowl, like you were doing something wrong. And I realized that that colored my judgment, and it caused me to be in a place where I tended to not interact with people around me as much as I had previously. And in fact, I remember Laura Lee telling me when I was in Kansas at one point, because we actually met there, I remember her telling me, I asked somebody at the table next to me a question about what they were eating, and she just said, what the hell are you doing? And I was like, I'm asking them what they're eating because it looks good. And she's like, oh, you don't do that.
No, you don't do that in Kansas, because when people go out to eat in Kansas, or in Kansas City, I should say, Midwest possibly, it's you don't feel like cooking, but you still, you know, you're going out with just your friends. And it's a you environment, and you don't interrupt people at another table. It's like a respect thing. It's when I was younger and I would go to restaurants with, you know, my parents and stuff, my sister would always sit next to, you know, my mom, and I would always sit next to my dad, and we were to keep to ourselves and not be bothersome, because the people next to us, you know, maybe trying to enjoy their evening and relax. And it was, you know, our responsibility in a public restaurant to not interrupt.
That whole argument, though, it just blows my mind. Exactly. it's so speechless.
Part of that, though, may have been she was young, and children should be seen and not heard.
Right. Now, they still behave that way now, Charles. So
No, as adult, you still act like that in a restaurant in Kansas City.
That sounds like a business opportunity to me. I'm going to start a chain of partitioned restaurants where these little
you can sit in a cubicle.
They're already out there. Like little booths someone's where capitalized you kind of almost practically That's shut Janine, the door. And they're the most popular restaurants. Yeah,
I've noticed a lot of places there's no door on them, but I noticed a lot of places have like a booth. And the booth does have these sort of partitions that go up just slightly higher than your head. So you can't really see anything except the people out in the middle. And the people on the sides, you can't really interact with them. And so one thing – so we're talking about, you know, just interactions and society and expectations and all of these things. So that totally threw me upside down, because I was used to interacting with people. Mm-hmm. I was used to kind of what I would consider communal eating. Mm-hmm. Because in San Francisco, if you go to a place – you're probably sitting at a table or damn near sitting at a table with someone that you don't know, because it's just crowded and, you know, but the food's good and it's okay. So I recently somehow snapped out of this mentality and started interacting with people. And it turns out, you know, the last four times I've gone out, I've met some of the most interesting people in the city just by having a conversation with the person next to me, if they're open to it, mm-hmm. right? It's not like I'm interrupting them. It's just, there's a person next to me. You know, and I say, oh, you know, hey, cool tattoo, or, oh, I look, you know, looks. What are you having? And we strike up a conversation, and I've noticed just by doing that, I practically end up sharing a table with somebody by the end of the night, and we make, you know, I make new friends.
That's the way to do it, is you have to be not hostile. You have to be giving, and you have to listen to them. You have to let them know that you're interested in them and you're willing to listen to them. And then I find my wife usually does this and starts conversations at tables and so on. But we have a good time.
Yeah, it's completely interesting that there's an entire culture of, I guess, a fairly large population in the U.S. anyway, that just doesn't, you know, just has their sort of blinders on when it comes to that social interaction. And the more I think about it, you know, I try not to judge things too harshly, but the more I think about it, I just think, well, that's wrong. Because it's like you said, a public place. You know, if you don't want to cook, order in if you don't want to interact with people. Because if you go somewhere where there are lots of people, by definition, you're in a group.
Make sure you order through the internet, too, so you don't have to make the phone call to talk to the person to convey your order.
No, see, the point is most of the time to get away from your kids, to go have a date night. And you can't order in because your kids are at home. And
that's why you wear your don't bug me, it's date night shirt out to the
out to the restaurant.
You'll have one of those?
No, we don't
well,
have one.
There's a market there. opportunity. Partitions and don't bug me. I'm on date night. Right.
No,
on.
See, because it's assumed. It's already assumed. So
if there are two people over 25 eating together in Kansas City, it's assumed that they're on a date night away from their kids.
You're wasting the babysitter's money by engaging with
them. Yeah. Exactly. You just, you don't,
this is
do that.
Funniest
if you
thing
know
I've ever
heard. Them, it's okay to wave from your table, but you don't walk up to their table and interrupt them. That's just not something you do.
I am that douchebag. I like every single time I saw somebody in a restaurant that I knew when I was there.
Did they look at you weird?
No weirder than they looked at me in general.
Okay.
So I just assumed I was, you know, being that guy again. But now I realize the social faux pas that I made.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting because
I reached down and grabbed a little bite of like one of their fries.
So you didn't stop it.
Dipped it in mayonnaise right in front
of them.
Good.
What are you guys up to?
Oh my God. No.
How are you guys doing? Sidled up next to the girl. Put my arm around her. Did my best Matthew McConaughey, you know.
Nice.
I'm talking about from Dazed and Confused, Matthew McConaughey.
Sure.
Not Fool's Gold. I mean, come on.
Right. There's a difference.
I find it interesting since we point out these subtle differences. Well, maybe not so subtle.
Dark differences, you might call them.
Subtle differences.
In
the difference
regions.
Between a universe and a speck of dust.
Hey. In these regions, I think maybe
they're both
some
matter.
Of our... I'm talking right now. Some of our pet peeves may come from, you know, different regions. And I mean, as like you said, you know, Kansas, I grew up there, so there's a strong chance that several of my pet peeves have like everything to do with the way you were supposed to or society and cultural norms in that region. And so I think maybe one of the things we should always try to keep into consideration when somebody does something that annoys us is, well, maybe that's normal for them. And that's okay. And so maybe they don't realize. And I think Charles made that point with the, you know, eyes closed.
I was just going to say, I think something else that you said, Charles, earlier that struck me or reminded me of something was that sort of maybe even unconscious drift towards people who have a similar set of experiences as you. And I remember reading once about this study. I think it was in the context of cellular automata, where these systems where you set up these little rules and you kind of see what behavior emerges as a means
like
of studying
Stephen Wolfram's
something.
New kind of science.
Yeah. And this one in particular was sort of it was, you know, it's game theory at this point because the rules are super simple, but they have this little checkerboard of, I think, three or four different races, different colored pegs, and they mixed up the board. And the idea is that this was a big neighborhood and that each turn in the game, they started out with the rule being that you wanted to be surrounded by three quarters of pegs like yours. So you can assume that's a sort of bigoted environment, right? These people wanted to be surrounded by people that were just like them, did not want to. And then, so you move things around and eventually, or very quickly, the map got segregated just of its own accord. These people moving to the places where they're going to be more likely to be surrounded by people. So then they crept down the racism value, if you will, down to only caring that 50%, only half the people that they're around are like them, and even down to 25%. What was interesting, and the idea that stuck with me, was that even at 25% racism, if you will, they only cared that they don't mind being the minority, right? Still, if you give the game enough turns, the board would end up segregating itself. It just took longer to do so, even with a non-racist outlook, if you will, from the players. That's I may be over-extrapolating, but to me...
No, that makes sense. I mean, it's like, you know, on a long... It's the Fight Club thing, right? On a long enough timeline, the survival rate of anyone drops to zero.
Right.
On a long enough timeline, even 1%, you know, bias toward a system causes that system to manifest itself. Absolutely.
Yeah. It sounds sort of like the rules for John Conway's Game of Life.
Yeah.
There was this is kind of different, but it just reminded me of that. So I don't know what it has to do with pet peeves. But I can't remember if it was, so here we go on one of my adventures where I try to describe something that I don't totally know about. I can't remember if I saw it or if I read about it. It was either a book or like a movie, but it was a social experimentation where you were actually shocked. Like they would send someone in a room and tell them to shock this other person if they answered questions incorrectly.
Right.
And no matter like how much they yelled out, they must shock them. Now, the person on the other end wasn't actually being
they
shocked.
Were acting, yeah.
Yeah, but it was how much people actually follow rules. And it was so, you know, the person would say, no, you must shock them. And, you know, if they answer this incorrectly. And the person on the other end would scream in pain and say, please don't hurt me. And it was, you know, how much they would actually go through the follow through and do it. And I can't remember if it was like a documentary I saw.
No, I
know
I think
it was in
you're
college.
Right. It was a well-known, I don't remember exactly when the studies happened, but I remember reading about it, too. It was studies around.
It sounds like the torture manuals.
Yeah.
And how people responded to authority specifically was one of the things they were figuring out.
And I guess, you know, a way it's like.
How did they respond? Would they shock people?
They all shocked.
They just did what they were told.
They did what they were told. And so, you know, I mean, I wonder how much that relates to, you know, society and people just. Doing what they're told, because what's interesting is they knew they were there voluntarily to do an experiment. They knew that they weren't. It wasn't at work. They weren't going to get in trouble.
Right.
And very few people said, "You know what? I'm done. I'm not going to shock this person." It was bizarre. I'll look that up. I'll figure out.
The guy in the white lab coat was very convincing.
Yes, he
and
was.
He has a white lab coat.
And it apparently happened a while ago, you know, like 50s or 60s maybe.
I think you're right, yeah.
I think it did.
We'll have to look up the study and put it in the notes.
We will.
You know, this might be connected. So, because I always try and find patterns, you know, that I can see. Because if I can see a pattern, then I can realize what it is that I'm reacting to. This might be another one of those patterns where... Yes, people are really good at following orders. I mean, that's why you have worker bees that are in companies doing TPS reports and all of these things. But it also might be the reason that they're really bad at being social is because no one ever gave them the manual or the class or the – I mean, there's no – you know, throughout high school and college and all this, there was no etiquette class. And actually, I'm completely shocked at – when I look back – and I moved around a lot, as I mentioned, but I'm completely shocked when I look back at high school at how much of a just an unmitigated fucking disaster the social meme in high school was. You know, you had popular –
We were required to take an etiquette class to graduate high school.
Was that just the women?
Yeah, it was.
Uh-huh.
Only the girls. Exactly. Yeah.
So, you know how I know that?
Why?
Observation.
Yeah. Because
I've been in the Midwest, in the area that you're in, and I observe that the women are very socially... There's some etiquette. I mean, I think it was like 1942 Miss Manners that they ignored most of or whatever, but but the men have... There's no etiquette at all. Like, there's no chewing with your mouth closed. And it's like no one, you know, no one really taught them to do that. Now, I'm sure their parents gave them some... semblance of an education on how to behave, but if only. But my perspective on it is, you know, is it possible that most people don't realize that they're taking up a lot of the sidewalk or sitting in the handicap and elderly seats, or sitting on the outside of the seat instead of the inside? Is it that they're just? I'm not even talking about an awareness, Charles. I'm saying because there was no training. You know, just like in high school, there was no training of how to be popular or how not to, you know, get beat up if you were nerdy. And, you know, there's no real training. So you end up just kind of flailing your way through it to find whatever works for you. Where you're in your own groove.
When I grew up, I was a real puny little kid, and even the girls picked on me. So that comment is rather close to my heart. And, you're right. It's just... people aren't aware, and they will do whatever they are socialized to do. But unfortunately, if they're growing up with the average parent, they're not really socialized to do anything except, I mean, the way people eat is telling. Can't you teach your kid to hold a knife and fork properly? Instead, you have kids who shovel it in and stuff like this. And I look at them and I say, ew, I'm not eating here again. But It's just one of those things. It's just the socialization process is absent. It's missing.
Has anyone seen WALL-E?
I have.
Yeah, we can't give away any spoilers.
No, we can't give away any spoilers. I don't want to do that. Ben, have you seen WALL-E?
I haven't seen it yet.
Oh, Ben.
Once you see WALL-E, we'll talk about
we'll,
it.
We'll talk about it.
There's
we'll
a whole,
do a
there's
follow
a whole,
up
yeah,
with WALL-E. Charles, you've seen it?
Yep. I had my podcast a couple of Fridays ago was about going to see WALL-E.
Nice.
Actually, that was a heck of a day. We went to see WALL-E. We went to see Get Smart. We went to see, what's the movie with Angelina Jolie? The last
Wanted.
One she's in?
Wanted.
Yeah. And we saw WALL-E. And that was a quadruple feature. And I went with a friend of mine. So it was a lot of fun and a lot of bonding.
Just out of curiosity, how was that experience for you? The experience, because I've always found whenever I'm in a movie theater, and I'm not trying to pry here, but whenever I'm in a movie theater, I always notice that there's like one crappy handicap seat in the far right hand, you know, side of the front, sort of middle row, in the place I wouldn't typically want to sit.
Actually, this is one great thing about the theater we were in is that it's on a wide aisle, and there's seats in the back. On the closer to the screen, and the seats way back to go up to the back of the theater, and it's a fairly wide aisle, and it's fairly right in the center of things. So I would in fact say that this would probably be one of the four or five seats that would be acceptable to your friend and from This Week in Media. It's just wonderful.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, we talk about pet peeves and things. I mean, the theater is definitely, like, we've talked about this before, and I probably mentioned it on that other show, but the theater is one of my biggest pet peeves. I mean, if you go to the theater here, you end up with a bunch of kids drinking 40-ounce, you know, you know, like whatever they are. I don't even know what
40 ounces of trouble.
40 ounces of trouble. Trouble with a horse on it. Isn't it Colt 45 or something? You see it like in the big bag. I don't know if that was just my generation, but
I don't know what it is, but it's.
I think you should remove someone's cell phone when they enter a theater.
I don't think you should remove someone's cell phone. I think that theaters should hire enough staff to put somebody in every theater, and you only need to pay this person minimum wage because they get to see all the new movies for free. So hire a movie enthusiast.
Oh yeah, when I was a kid, being an usher was like a home run job when you were 15 or 16.
Yeah.
Being a movie usher, you got to see free movies and all that other stuff.
Exactly, and I just have them sit in the theater. Your cell phone goes off. I'm sorry, I'm gonna have to ask you to leave. You talk too loud. I'm sorry, it's time for you to leave. You're drinking.
Yeah,
imagine some
out.
Night vision goggles and really good aim and a non-lethal weapon would probably be
similar—a
similar sort of solution.
Just a little trank. I actually, you know, it's interesting that this relates, and it's funny. This is why it's a meta peeve. This relates directly to customer service because when I was younger, they did have ushers in a lot of theaters. I mean, if you went to the theater, if you had somebody in front of you who was, you know, misbehaving in a way, and you were like, excuse me, do you mind, you know, keeping it down? And they turned around and they were like, F you, man, I'll kick your ass, bitch. You know, which is, I'm just saying 9 out of 10 times if you ask someone to keep it down. If they're under
script.
25, that's the script. You're not my father, old man. No, actually, I don't get that yet, but I did once. It kind of knocked me out. I was like, hey, dude, I'm closer to your age than you think. But it's interesting because it used to be that there was an usher that would walk around. Mm-hmm. That's all you need. I mean, that's all you need, a little customer service. Have an usher walk around, and if someone's, you know, throwing their peanut M&Ms at the seat in front of them or kicking the chair or flicking popcorn or text messaging. I don't understand what it is about people who have these giant, super, ultra, mega, hyper bright screens on their Sidekick, and then they flip it out, and it's making noise, and they're texting, and they're, you know, of course, they're always totally within the line of sight of the film, so it just takes you right out of the movie, right? Just this bright, shiny light.
So here's another idea. Speaking of sort of the basis behind the peeves, what when you act in a way that is is not accounting for the needs of those around you or the desires of those around you, in this case, like the sidekicking in the theater sort of thing. You're imposing a cost on those people around you, right? The cost of frustration. It's that unwillingness or uncaring of recognizing that cost that seems to be behind that activity, right? It's Charles, this goes maybe back a little bit to what you were saying, just that eyes not open are related to these things. Are we just not teaching each other enough about being aware of that impact?
Actually, I find most people go through life with all their senses turned off. If we were paramecium, we'd be dead. I cannot fathom for a life of me how people can go through life so unaware of anything. And yet they do. I end up working for these guys.
Aren't they, on the one hand, aren't they just sort of living out the American dream of acting their own self-interest? Isn't all this stuff supposed to sort of come out in the wash if we just take care of ourselves and not necessarily look at others?
Actually, that's the horrible part about the American dream, and it's partially bullshit, is that John O'Rourke, the hero of... An Ayn Rand novel, and The Architect. I can't remember.
Oh, yeah,
right
I know what you're
now,
talking about.
He was,
yeah,
not building his building because he couldn't build them right, and so on. And it's on the one hand, yes, this is the ultimate American dream, and on the other hand, it's like, what kind of a sociopath was this guy? And most people tend to be vacillating between being nice people and being utter sociopaths.
Yeah, I agree with you. There's this sort of the all these other assholes phenomena is what I call it, where, you know, I don't care about all these other assholes. And then you just flip that and everyone's doing that to each other. So to everyone else around you, you're one of the assholes that are not being cared about at any given time.
You know, it's the sort of like goes in with my other... We pick people we like according to our seven deadly sins, the seven basic human motivational vectors. And your friends tend to be the ones who share your top three sins, and the ones that you hate tend to share your bottom three sins. So I just look for people who share my sins, sloth, lust, and gluttony.
Interesting. I've never thought of that. I do find, on a similar topic, people with really close personalities to mine, I do not get along with them. Like, initially meeting them, I don't like them. And yet, I can recognize that they have a very similar personality. As I do. So I'm wondering, like, what is it about me or my personality? Like, do they not like me too? Are they pretending? Are we both pretending to like each other? Because if we're so close,
right,
they probably don't like me either, but they seem to.
That brings up a good one.
Actually, I think the problem is yours, my dear, because people share your top three sins are you're going to be your best friends.
No, my best friends and I, my two best friends, we've been friends for 10 years.
You're smoking pot. Your two best friends are exactly like you.
You think so?
The things that they like.
Yeah, in things we like, but personality-wise,
I don't know if stubbornness, bullheaded, and know-it-allness are three of the deadly sins.
But those are second class.
If they are,
sins,
these
yes
are the three things that they share with in common with a bullet.
Well, then how is it? No, Jessica's not vain.
I'm just saying, vanity. Isn't vanity one of the seven sins?
Yep.
Yeah. So vanity. You guys all have vanity in common.
You think? I don't think Jessica
that's
has vanity.
That is stubbornness.
Okay, stubborn, I'll get you there.
No, but
that's not one of the seven.
No, but stubbornness is part of vanity.
Oh, I see. Okay.
You are vain and believe yourself to be true and accurate and correct. Therefore, you are. I'm not saying you, Laura Lee.
Yeah,
I'm saying you, the person. I'm saying all those other assholes who are vain. That's part of vanity, is stubbornness, sort of knowing the right answer and thinking everyone else is wrong. That's vanity.
Stubborn, yeah. That's true.
Nice. It's the things with the thing about knowing your seven deadly sins. You remember the acronym PUSOGL: pride, envy, wrath, sloth, avarice, Lust and Gluttony, Fussagel.
That was a really good movie with the seven deadly sins. That's the first time I'd heard of them.
David
FYI.
Fincher, by the way. Fincher.
With Brad Pitt. That's the first time I'd heard the seven deadly sins.
I believe the film was called Seven.
Oh, it was.
and it's a remake of something with Sophia Loren or something in the 60s. But it's an internal theme. It'll come up again and again. You know, and if I wanted to, I'd call up IMDb.
I can't say that acronym really rolls off the tongue. What was that? What was the mnemonic for that again?
What was it? Flava Flav? Is that what you're saying?
Pusoggle.
Pusoggle.
Pusoggle. It'd be a good code word amongst friends.
I think it's interesting. We're talking about seven deadly sins, and earlier we were talking about eating. And, you know, people who just shove food. I have this theory. We're talking about how people are raised and stuff like this. And this is, you know, this is the sort of in line with the people who share your top three sins. I think you can judge how good a person is in bed by watching them eat. And I'll give you an example. If someone takes their time and really enjoys the food and they, you know, cut their bites into small-ish portions but not so small as to be dainty, that person is probably going to be a pretty decent lover. If they just cram food into their mouth, they're a wham, bam, thank you, ma'am kind of person. And you laugh or you think it's crazy, but you're going to watch.
And then
you're going to look around and you're going to be like, I totally slept with that dude and it was terrible. Look at him eat. Look at the way he puts popcorn in his mouth. That's how he fucks. Oh, I'm just saying. So that's part of
that's hilarious.
You fuck like you eat. That's part of my whole. I'm gonna have to bleep this out. We'll just edit all that out in post, Ben.
There might be a double explicit.
The explicit tag.
We add more than one.
Explicit with an exclamation point.
I'll just give us seven this time. Well, we've given you plenty of data, and I mean the listeners, plenty of data to unlock our personalities. If you want to send us your tasty insights into how to manipulate us based on what we have given to you about our lives, you can contact us at lifezero@me.com. And Charles, thanks so much for being on the show. If people want to know a little bit more about you, which I'm sure they will after the conversation, how can they find you?
And just get on to msbpodcast.com. There's all kinds of things and feedback mechanisms that they can email me.
Great.
And it's just msbpodcast.com.
Great. We'll make sure to put that in the show notes as well so everyone can find you. Well, I think we've covered at least one round of pet peeves. I think for the next month or so, we'll just cover this once per episode.
I didn't even talk. I'll put a list up because I totally mentioned like three pet peeves. I think.
What I think we should talk about in an upcoming episode is if we're going to come back to this topic, we should talk about the things that we do that drive ourselves nuts, because that seems like in the context of what we've been talking about in other shows. That's sort of our own.
Right.
Our own peevedness.
Point the finger back at ourselves a little bit. That would be interesting.
Yeah.
Or ask ourselves, what are the things that we do that could cause other people to be frustrated?
Right.
Because
awareness
we've talked a lot about
it.
And I'm a big, as you know, the food thing goes back to awareness. I'm a big fan of awareness because I think, and we've talked about this ad nauseum on the show, but once you are aware of what causes a reasonable person to behave in a way that you consider to be unreasonable, then suddenly they don't seem unreasonable anymore. You know? Does that make sense to you, Laralee?
No, not at all.
So
was I staring at you blankly?
You were. You were staring at me glossy-eyed like you were making a shopping list.
Hey, you guys were talking about some pretty heavy stuff when I was making my shopping list.
No, I was just saying it's the sort of, you know, put yourself in someone else's shoes. But it's a little more complicated because it is, you know, try and understand what causes a person to behave the way they're behaving. Because once you understand why they do what they do, it can make sense. I think we have a responsibility on this planet to try and understand each other.
Most of what people do, from their perspective anyway, they're being logically consistent, right? Nobody goes around thinking, boy, this is a dumb thing for me to do. They think they're doing the right thing given the circumstances.
Right.
Down to that woman who is talking on the phone. She is making the right when you're trying to get your FedEx package.
Yeah, she doesn't even realize probably.
Right. She's doing
she just
exactly
thinks all these
thinks.
Other assholes are mis, you know, are right. behaving in a way right. that's totally
so
unreasonable.
So if you can get
her.
Into her logic bubble, get into right. the world and where that is the right thing to do at that time, right? You've unlocked that personality.
In her case, unfortunately, I would have to go through a prefrontal lobe lobotomy procedure.
Yep.
In order to get into her frame
no,
of reference.
No, it's really simple. LaToya slept with, you right. know, Keith, and so did Lakeisha, and now LaToya might be pregnant, but you see, Lakeisha's already got a baby with Tony.
This is like an exact conversation
I know,
overheard.
That she has. Exactly.
Were you
These
there,
are her conversations. I have run into this girl.
Because you weren't there when I was there.
I was not there when you were there, but I have been to that Kinko's and had that same experience.
You weren't on
and
the other
I'm
end
saying,
of the phone, were you?
The thing is, in this... No.
Wait, is your real name LaToya?
No. No. It's not. The thing is, in her head, I think it's easy to get into her head. Her life has revolved around the drama that has been created due to the area and the people around her that grew up in. To her, those are really big deals because there's either going to be a bitch fight that night or, you know, whatever. I don't know what happens in that situation. But it's to her, that's like... That's what's important because, you know, growing up, she probably overheard adults or older people having those conversations and interacting in that way. Therefore, she's completely unaware that that's not an appropriate conversation at work and that she should be, you know, reserving that for later.
Well, that's how
the
Keith
problem
and
with
her,
that is that you start getting into generational things, and you can get into all kinds of difficulties with like a generation. I knew a woman who was 26 years old, and she was a grandmother. She was 13, and she got pregnant at 13, mm-hmm. and her daughter followed in exactly the same pattern. Was it environment? Was it genetic? Was it whatever? But 26-year-old and a grandmother. And so you can get into all kinds of situations where if you try and look at the perpetuation of things, it can lead you rather astray. Same thing with my situations that I've run into at work. And you sit there and you say, okay, well, I was a real pain in the ass, but I wanted to be. Or I was this was my boss at the time, and as a manager, he was a great programmer. But I wouldn't. I've learned everything about optimization and optimizing compilers from him, and there's nothing more that I can learn from him. But one thing I needed to learn from him was, what the heck do I do here? Don't tell me about optimizing and rewriting code and shit like this, because this is not the problem. The problem is human resources is, you know, and you end up with these kinds of perpetuation of faults, which you sort of have to, I've learned over the years, you have to give and take and break them off. Just lay back and chill.
Break the cycle, if you will.
Yeah.
Hi, this is Ben. You may know me from the popular podcast Life Zero. In episode 9 of Life Zero, we're going to explore some things. The list of those things includes... Fuck, I gotta try that one.
That was good, though.
Pet peeves,
Hi.
Paria, and paramecium.
Pet peeves, paria. Paria.
Yeah.
Okay. Hi. This is Ben Durbin. You may know me from the somewhat popular. No, I need a self-deprecating. We don't want to say popular. Hi, this is Ben Durbin. You may know me from the celebrated.
Oft celebrated.
Oft.